Alaskans, we're still dealing with a pandemic. Longer nights and seasonal affective disorder don't make it any easier. We encourage you to take care of both your mental and physical health this winter. Get outside. Enjoy traditional foods. Connect with your community. And keep your body moving. Let's take care of ourselves and each other.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. As the nation commemorates 80 years since the Japanese invasion of Pearl Harbor, we'll take a moment to also reflect on the perspective from the indigenous people of Hawaii. The islands remain a strategic U.S. military post, and the military presence before and since the attack has had deep and ongoing effect on the culture and sovereignty of Kanaka Maoli. We'll hear about the Native history around Pearl Harbor and efforts to reclaim the narrative right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Biden administration's infrastructure bill has a number of key investments for Indian country, including broadband connectivity. A tribal educator in Nevada says broadband access is desperately needed in her community. Suzanne Potter has more.
Lynn Manning John, vice principal of the Owyhee Combined School on the Duck Valley Indian Reservation, says her community desperately needs better coverage and more bandwidth.
In the building, we struggle with the internet going out regularly because the kids are on Chromebooks, and because of our location, which is 100 miles from Elko, it sometimes takes us a day or two to get our internet back up.
She says the area only has a single cell tower, and 90% of families have no internet service at home. Rural areas often lack communication infrastructure because the customer base is too small to provide a return on the telecom company's investment. Manning John says the future of her community, part of the Shoshone Paiute tribe, depends on better broadband.
It cannot be left up to the market. These kids have a need. Internet is just as essential as indoor plumbing and electricity. It needs to be provided on the scale that we do any type of public service.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
California Assemblymember James Ramos hosted a discussion Friday with tribal leaders, educators, and students concerning California Indian education. Ramos talked about the need for public schools to teach California Native American history. A bill he introduced in the legislature calls for state curriculum to include Native American history and culture to increase knowledge about California tribes and their impacts. Here's Ramos commenting on his bill during Friday's event in Palm Desert, which was streamed online.
Working together as one body, moving together in a coalition, we're going to be able to make a change in the state of California. We have an opportunity as California Indian people, through myself as being the first California Indian elected in the state legislature, to push a bill, AB 1554, and it's called the California Indian Education Act, that's going to start to focus on California's first people. But it starts with our elders and those that have had vision to move forward with education and teaching the people who we truly are as California Indian people.
Ramos says education about Native Americans can help correct ignorance and bias in educational systems. He gave an update on a meeting he had last month with the Riverside Unified School District. The meeting was held after a video went viral of a teacher in the school district mocking Native American dance and wearing a faux headdress to teach math concepts. According to Ramos, the district is working on curriculum and policy for Native American education and is moving to create a local task force with tribes. Ramos also advocated for California Indian Nations College to receive federal accreditation. The St. Regis Mohawk Tribe in New York is teaming up with a local church and charitable organization to help bring food boxes to the community. The tribe and the Mohawk Assembly of God will distribute boxes next week. More than 1,500 boxes will include fresh foods like milk, yogurt, fruits, and vegetables. The food boxes are sponsored by the tribe, the church, and in collaboration with CityServe and Rural Compassion. Alaska's largest statewide Native organization is gearing up for its annual convention. The Alaska Federation of Natives event will take place next week virtually due to COVID-19 health and safety concerns. The AFN is recognizing 50 years from the passage and implementation of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Discussions will explore the law and its impacts. The agenda also includes a number of priorities, from healthcare, hunting and fishing rights, to infrastructure needs. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
There are now booster recommendations for all three available COVID-19 vaccines in the United States, and you may choose which booster shot you receive. More info at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus, who support this show.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. It's been 80 years since Japan attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, spurring the United States' entry into World War II. And every year since, officials recognize the historical event and the bravery of the service members who were killed or wounded. Another side of that day comes from the indigenous people who were living in the Hawaiian Islands long before the U.S. military showed up. Their view extends well before the infamous attack and continues to the present day. Coming up, we're going to explore the U.S. military's existence in Hawaii and its effects on Native Hawaiian culture, sovereignty, and connections to land. You can join our conversation too. What do you know about Pearl Harbor? There were several Native service members who lost their lives there. How well are they remembered? What role should U.S. military play in Hawaii now? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Oahu, Hawaii is Dr. Kyle Kajihiro. He's a lecturer in the Department of Geography and Environment and the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Welcome to Native America Calling, Dr. Kajihiro.
Aloha, Andy. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. So kind of set the scene for us and that time in Hawaii, which was 1941. Why was the U.S. military there and what was going on with Japan?
Right. So I think this is one of the dilemmas, is that most of the history only starts in 1941. And the people in Hawaii, especially Kanaka Maoli, I have a longer history of Pearl Harbor. The tragedy of Pearl Harbor began much earlier than that. And so when you look at the attack on U.S. forces in Pearl Harbor, and that's a very important point, they weren't bombing Hawaiian fish ponds or agricultural sites, the taro fields in the Ewa district. They were bombing the U.S. Navy that had been massing there, preparing to isolate and cut off Japan from its resources. So I think we have to understand that World War II and the bombing of Pearl Harbor was an inter-imperialist war. These are two imperial countries that were fighting over control of this strategic area of the world, the Pacific Ocean, and Hawaii was a key for that.
All right. And so World War II pretty much had already started. Where was Japan in all of what was going on in World War II?
Well, you know, Japan was sort of following the same imperialist playbook in invasion and occupation of Korea and China, Taiwan, And then they were moving throughout Southeast Asia. So they were a horribly violent and destructive force in the Pacific, but they sort of rationalized it that they were doing the same sort of policy that European imperialist countries were doing. Meanwhile, the United States in Hawaii was here precisely because Hawaii was seen as a launching pad, a stepping stone for the United States to project its power across the Pacific. And so if you go back, you know, to the 19th century, in 1872, General John Schofield came to Hawaii disguised as a tourist, and he was writing back a secret report on a suitable location for a military base. So here you have a foreign spy, basically, under cover of tourism, spying on the Hawaiian kingdom and deciding that Pu'uloa, or what people now know as Pearl Harbor, was the key to the Central Pacific Ocean. He said that the fish ponds and the taro fields there that were feeding the people of Oahu was valueless. Instead, all he saw was the military utility. So that's the way, that's where Hawaii fits into the U.S. imperialist imaginary, is a tool, a useful tool. And so, you know, that was the first Pacific pivot began in Hawaii when the United States set its sights where the frontier extended from the continent across the Pacific to Hawaii, and then, you know, desiring to reach Asia.
Okay. All right. And we know that, you know, the attack at Pearl Harbor was what, you know, America needed to be just tipped into World War II and, you know, really change things for Japan. But how did the attack at Pearl Harbor change how Japanese and Asian people were treated in Hawaii as well?
That's a great question. So I'm I'm a fourth generation Japanese in Hawaii, myself, and you know our family has stories of the kind of crackdown that happened and the fear that people felt, where you know because of our ethnicity we were branded as enemy aliens, and so people destroyed family heirlooms, cultural artifacts that would have linked them and or made them suspicious as you know supporters of Imperial Japan. And, you know, there were several thousand people in Hawaii who were incarcerated in concentration camps. Unlike Japanese Americans on the continent, where, you know, 20,000 or more, everyone was rounded up in some camps, here in Hawaii it was done selectively. And so it became sort of like a stigma. If your family had someone who was hauled off by the FBI and put into a camp, they didn't know where they went, what happened. And so I think it ripped our communities apart.
Okay. All right. And you mentioned, you know, a little bit about how the military viewed Hawaii as sort of like this base for just the military and nothing else. All the other resources didn't really matter so much. So how much of the military, the American military, were present at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, just right at the 1941, just right there at the event of the attack?
Well, I don't recall the exact numbers of troops, but a tremendous buildup was already underway, and the United States decided to move the Pacific Fleet from the West Coast to Hawaii. So the fleet was here at Pearl Harbor, and Japan saw that as a threat, but they also saw it as an opportunity to try to strike a paralyzing blow against the U.S. military to get buy them more time in the war. And so Hawaii became, you know, a casualty of this battle between two imperial powers, right? And it's it was a tremendous ecological tragedy. It was a social tragedy. During the war, martial law was imposed for 3 years. And so the military controlled everything from the courts to media. You couldn't strike or quit your job. And during that time, they seized hundreds of thousands of acres of land. And most of the land was from the Hawaiian Kingdom lands, what are known as the Hawaiian Trust lands. These are crown and government lands of the Hawaiian Kingdom that the United States kind of holds in trust. And so those lands are still the basis of the military's land holdings in Hawaii. There's something like 68% of the military's 221,000 acres of land are these Hawaiian national lands.
Got it. All right. Right after this break that's coming up, we'll bring in two more professors from the University of Hawaii to bring in more perspective about the Hawaiian Kingdom and how, the meeting between the people of the Hawaiian Kingdom and Americans happened in the first place, and what kind of led over to what is now called, commonly kind of called, an overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom. But, Dr. Kajihiro, you're talking about martial law. You're talking about how Japanese people were treated around this time after the attack of Pearl Harbor. Where were Native Hawaiians? Were they also, sucked into all of this martial law? And what happened after the attack?
Well, yeah, I mean, everyone was, under military rule at that point. I think most people felt that the attack was an affront to them and, and the people of Hawaii, and so wanted to support the war effort. But also many Hawaiian families lost their land during this period. I'll give you one example is in the Valley Waikane on the windward side of Oahu. The Kamaka family had some very verdant lands where they grew all kinds of agriculture. It had ancient terraces for growing these crops. And those lands were used by the military during World War II. After the war, they promised to clean up the unexploded ordnance and return it. But when bombs started to turn up, the military condemned these lands, and they lost it. And Uncle Raymond Kamaka, one of the elders, had been farming there, and he fought it in court. He refused to take their money. He went to prison for 2 years for refusing to pay taxes and protest. And that land is still contaminated with unexploded bombs. And so there's thousands of military contamination sites throughout the island. Many of them are with unexploded ordnance, but everything else from toxic chemicals that are leaching into the groundwater. And right now we have a huge issue with these 80-year-old fuel tanks at Red Hill that have been leaking. And they sit 100 feet over the aquifer that supplies water to Honolulu.
Got it. All right, Dr. Kajihiro, thank you for that. We'll be back right after this break. I know he mentioned environment. He mentioned Red Hill. That is a whole nother issue we'll get into right after this break. So stay with us, 1-800-996-2848, if you would like to join us. The newest census numbers show growing populations of Native Americans across the country. But how will those same numbers be used to draw voting district boundaries? Several tribes are already expressing concern about the prospect of officials weakening their voting power. We'll hear more about it on the next Native America Calling.
The COVID-19 vaccine rollout for children ages 5 to 11 years old is already well underway. Children who get the vaccine will receive strong protection against the COVID-19 disease, and getting children vaccinated will help keep all members of our communities safe. You can contact your child's health care provider or tribal health department to schedule their vaccine appointment today. Support for this program is provided by the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health.
You are listening to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. We're talking about Indigenous perspectives on Pearl Harbor and Hawaii today. How do you view Pearl Harbor and World War II? Are there veterans in your family from this time? Call in and tell us about them. We are at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And I'd like to bring in another guest today. We have Manu Kaiyama joining us from Kelepulu, Hawaii. She is a professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, teaching at the Schuyler College of Business and the Center of Hawaiian Studies. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Manu.
Aloha mai kakou.
Hi. All right. Well, thanks for joining us. Dr. Kajihiro just mentioned, how all of these different resources were contaminated in Hawaii just from, the military being present there, and also from that huge event, that attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. Before we go back and talk about the occupation of Hawaii by Americans, can you kind of expand a little bit more on this issue? He mentioned Red Hill. He mentioned places where there's been contamination. Can you just expand on that a little bit?
Sure. our Pu'uloa, which is Pearl Harbor, is our name for Pearl Harbor. It's really important to understand that when the American, it didn't just become polluted after the bombing. Before that, they were already digging out Pearl Harbor and changing its natural ecosystem, which Hawaiians farmed and provided hundreds of thousands of people with food, with fish, with oysters, with taro, and that all got sacrificed for the American military. And where our people got food from after that was an afterthought. So they turned Pearl Harbor, or our Pu'uloa, from our icebox, basically, especially for all the people living on the Ewa, all the way through Honolulu town areas, into a Superfund site instead. So now, rather than being a home and a source of food and life-giving things, it's turned into a Superfund. It's one of the most toxic places in the world. And that's a history that we have, and it's just one of many from the military occupation of Hawaii. I know that Kyle spoke a little bit about Red Hill. Mm-hmm. These are Navy fuel tanks that are located a little bit north of Moanalua and Waimalu. It's our aquifer. So we as islands get our water from aquifers beneath us, and we pump the water up. And the water comes from the rainfall, and it seeps through all the porous rocks. It gets, purified and goes into these aquifers. And it's located Mauka, or up towards the mountainside of Pearl Harbor, because they utilize the gravity to allow the fuel that is kept in these tanks to run down into Pearl Harbor in order to be loaded into, the ships that need it. And what's happened here is, I think it's about 1940, they found a need to place, of course, this is right because of the war, and the war gave the American military all kinds of reasons to co-opt and take Hawaiian land and Hawaiian resources. But they needed some type of place to house fuel tanks. So there are 20 huge, massive, 250 feet tall tanks dug underground into this hill, and we used to call it Kapukaki, but they named Red Hill, and it holds a total of 250 million gallons of petroleum fuel, and so, again, it's to, of course, carry fuel to the ships in Pearl Harbor. Now, this strategic location is only 100 feet above Moanalua Waimalu Aquifer. And like I said, it serves, you know, water to hundreds of thousands of residents, military, visitors, extending from Halawa all the way to Hawaii Kai. A conservative estimate is that over the last 70-plus years, 180,000 gallons have spilled due to leaks, mismanagement, earthquakes, which Hawaii, you know, being a moving plate in the Pacific, right? We're going to see those kinds of accidents happen. And it's spilled into these aquifers, polluting them. You know, it's really difficult because when we look at these people, and we just recently were told of another spill. We find that the military, Navy specifically, has been hiding these spills from us people, and it includes many people, not just the native people, but they've been concealing it. But this time, which has just recently happened, there were homesteads and people living downstream from where the tanks are located to Pearl Harbor, saying their water smelled funny, it tasted funny. When they take a bath, their skin is burning. And they had to then address the fact that we did have an astronomical leak, and they finally had to do something. I think it's really important to note also that we've known about the degradation of these tanks for years and years and years. And the Hawaiian population has been saying, you have to take care of this because it is totally going to take out this, our natural resource of water for hundreds of thousands of people. And they kept stalling and saying, oh, we can't do that. We can't do this. Oh, they're fine. We've looked at it. They're fine. And we basically need the leaders who are in charge to have the courage to say, you know, yeah, maybe we need to take these out of, they are antiquated, they're old, and we need to do something to protect the local people, to protect the people living here who really, and all of us who rely on this source of clean and fresh water. And I dare to think or to guess that there's no chance at this moment that they're going to do this. And that is because Hawaii is forced to be the host to the 2022 RIMPAC exercises, you know, in which case, I mean, I don't know if you want me to get into RIMPAC exercises, but they're going to have, this is basically in the summer months, these military exercises take place in Hawaii. And this year promises to be much larger than 2018, the pre-COVID numbers that they had, where they at that time housed 25 nations, 46 surface ships, 5 submarines, 18 National Land Forces, and I believe more than 200 aircraft. And we're looking at 25,000 personnel. All of this destruction in Hawaiian waters and Hawaiian lands, you know. So I think the activity itself, they're going to need to refuel all of these invited ships. And I have a sense that they're not going to want to do anything with these towers that are holding all of this fuel because of the impending RIMPAC.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for those updates there. Very interesting how, you know, just the military presence there is just this big, vast presence. I mean, it's fascinating as well. When I was doing all this research on Pearl Harbor and just reading about how many ships and how many people and how many tons of bombs were used at this time, it's just... thinking of it in terms of size, it's huge. And then also thinking of it in terms of how devastating it was to people and to well, especially people in the Navy, how devastating it was for everybody and their connections to family and loved ones on the mainland and everything. It was a huge loss that, you know, of course we think about every single year. But what is the legacy of Pearl Harbor for Native Hawaiians like yourself, Manu?
Well, if you're talking about the legacy, it is hu'uloa to me. Mm-hmm. Like I said earlier, it was historically used and sustained by Hawaiians to provide food. I mean, it was originally named Pearl Harbor because we actually had oysters there and with pearls, and you can't find that anymore. I mean, it's just been disseminated. So I do believe that the legacy of Pearl Harbor is not a good one anymore since the American military took over, and that is their reputation. They come into a place and they say, don't worry, we'll be returning this to you and we'll make it like it was when we arrived. And instead, they become overwhelmed because it's so decimated that they just throw up their hands and say, oh, sorry, we'll condemn it and you cannot use it. You know, Dr. Kajihiro had talked briefly about one example, which was the example in Waikane and with the Kamaka family. There are so many examples of the military traveling throughout the islands. My personal is Makua, and Makua Valley is an area where my family lived, and they had to leave because of World War II, and they were going to use this entire valley for bombing practice. They promised to return it to our families when they were finished with World War II, and of course it is still in military hands. They always need things for something, and they never keep their word. So this can be quite frustrating. I'm sure you've heard of Koho'olawe. Koho'olawe was a win for us, maybe, right? This island, we lost two courageous young men in this fight to get our island returned to us. The military had really done so much damage to this entire island, the target island, that they were not able to repair it. And even though we won it back, you would say, or it was returned to us in 1990 through the first Bush, it was never restored. And we still are not able to utilize it as we used to before the Navy took it over as target practice. We used it for, our people used it for astronomical sightings, for going up and practicing astronomy. We used it for fishing. So it definitely cannot be used for those things since all of our sites were purposefully targeted and destroyed. So our history here in Hawaii, Pearl Harbor is just a small hint of how much land. And the reason I say maybe so for Koho'olawe is because, yes, they returned that island. But in the meantime, Kyle can probably expand on, they then amassed a whole bunch of other land in other places that actually exceeded the size of Koho'olawe. So they have been horrible people to do business with, especially since they do break their contracts all the time. And there really is no redress for us as the people living here. There's no way for us to say, hey, you know, or to sue them or to ask for accountability. So it's a very difficult place to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It sounds very familiar with how our history is here on the mainland with tribes and the government as well. And, you know, for listeners out there, if you're making connections to dealings with the American military and the government, I mean, you must be making those same kind of connections as I am just listening to Manu here talk about taking of land and promising and breaking those promises. Give us a call and tell us how you view Pearl Harbor when it comes to, you know, just thinking about our fellow indigenous people over there in Hawaii. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Also, if you have a question about all of this, about these times in history, you can give us a call. We have three experts here. That's, again, 1-800-996-2848. And Manu, let's go back then. Let's go back to the Kingdom of Hawaii, just before Americans came over. You were talking about Pearl Harbor. It was just this ice box. It was an awesome place that fed people, that you know, was very important to the people. So yeah, Hawaii was a completely different thing before Americans came over. But can you talk about the Kingdom of Hawaii just before it turned into something else?
Well, truly the expert on this is Dr. Tsai, but I can give him an introduction because...
Okay, yeah, we're going to go to a break in just a minute.
Okay, before Kingdom time, I mean, the American occupation of Hawaii, and before we even became an independent nation, before that, you know, we were ruled, with rules. We were very active in farming. The first people who came and saw Hawaiians in action, they were impressed and amazed at how every single foot of land was used for something. And that was our belief. And our religion was, of course, to honor the land and to honor the ocean because they gave us life. And we honored it by caring for it and making sure that it was useful, that it was productive. Made the best fish farms you could ever imagine, which we call Loko'i'a. We took land resources, and our fish farms were along the coasts where they were appropriate. They made use of freshwater springs. Mm-hmm.
All right. Sorry about that. We have to get to this break. We'll be back talking about Hawaii and the legacy of Pearl Harbor just after this. Stay tuned.
Ah, chest spukani, in chest biowitins sheet, see chest Mariamistins huitish. Inchin kaint luanui, nechluas in quelli huyatwa. Chquokul tausish to skelly such Mariam yach sachem. Chquimint healthcare.gov, uqua chquokul tausin, 1-800-318-2596, quol nacht smeet. Yets mamit in Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy, and we're focusing on Pearl Harbor and Hawaii today. Do you have questions about Pearl Harbor or the U.S. occupation of Hawaii? There's time to join a conversation. We're at 1-800-996-2848. And right before the break, our guest, Manu Kaʻiama, professor over at the University of Hawaii, was just talking about the natural state of Hawaii before Americans came over and you know, pretty much turned it into a military base. And, you know, I guess the current vision of Hawaii is kind of the same. It's this place with... you know, lots of places to vacation and relax and go on your honeymoon. And it is the spot for everybody to take a vacation. I'd like to know what you guys think about that. But we do have a caller on the line who's kind of has a comment about the same thing. So Jennifer in Algodones, New Mexico, listening on KUNM. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Andy. First off, I'm actually of mostly Caucasian, but some Japanese heritage. So I've always been really uncomfortable with Pearl Harbor Day, and I've never wanted anything to do with it. That's kind of a comment. But then the main thing I'm calling about is I just got back a couple of weeks ago from my very first visit to Hawaii. I was lucky enough to spend 8 days on Kauai. Just amazing. It blew me away. But I had this nagging, uncomfortable sense. You know, I was watching all of us tourists, and it embarrassed me. And I thought, you know, it is really kind of a healing place, but what can we tourists from the mainland do other than just relax and kind of use the place, which kind of just further creates an occupation thing in my mind? Is there anything that we tourists can do to actually be useful to the indigenous community and just to Hawaii locals in general?
Got it. All right, Jennifer, thank you so much. Manu, what's your response to Jennifer?
You know, I appreciate that question. And you guys are inculcated or brainwashed by a billion-dollar industry that tells you to come to Hawaii. And Hawaii is very beautiful in many places. Those places are shrinking rapidly. We have about 1.2 million, well, maybe 1.5 million people living here, but we have over 15 million people visit here. They drink all of our water, they eat things, and of course, we all think, well, we need to go because tourism is the main, right, economic engine. It's tourism, and secondly, military. And we'd like to cut back on both of those. So I appreciate the sensitive tourist who comes and says, well, what can I do? There are tourist opportunities that take that into account, eco-tourists, where you go and you help and you learn how to plant kalo, and that kalo will be eaten by someone. Or you go and you clean the beach. So there are things like that. So it's not resting in your, you know, your high rise and looking out at the water. Don't use a certain type of suntan lotion because it's killing our reefs. I mean, quite frankly, I wish we could pick and choose who comes to our land, but we can't. And so for now, since tourism is our number one economic driver, then we need to figure out ways to make better tourists, you know, come here. So thank you for that question. But you need to understand that I'm not speaking for all Native people, but a lot of us Aboriginal Native Hawaiians just wish there were no tourists at all.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you for that. Now, let's go over to Oahu, Hawaii, where we have Dr. Keanu Sai joining us. He's a political scientist and a Hawaiian subject. Welcome to Native America Calling, Dr. Sai.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining. So Manu just kind of trying to introduce you right before the break, where I asked her about the kingdom of Hawaii just before Americans came over. Can you kind of set up what this kingdom was all about and how it was, you know, operating before Americans came over?
Well, if you notice the flag, the flag in Hawaii, there's a Union Jack on the top left corner. And then there's red and white and blue stripes for each of the islands, 8 islands. We used to be a part of the British Empire, actually as a British protectorate. King Kamehameha I, who consolidated the islands under one rule, joined the British Empire voluntarily. And that status was maintained until 1843, when Hawaii was recognized, Great Britain recognized Hawaii as an independent state. So by 1893, the Hawaiian Kingdom had over 90 embassies and consulates all over the world. And it was also a recognized neutral country by virtue of treaties. So we were like the Switzerland in the Pacific. So you had 4 neutral countries in the 19th century, Switzerland, Belgium, Luxembourg, and Hawaii. A lot of people don't know that. And what's been absent from many conversations, which would include Pearl Harbor, and as Kyle rightfully stated, people have stated that it's as if the history, American history, started in 1941 here in Hawaii. Well, back in the kingdom, as a country, the Hawaiian kingdom, it was a fully functioning entity, very progressive. It had universal health care. It had compulsory education, right? It had colleges along with the common schools. And people in the Hawaiian kingdom were called Hawaiian subjects. So as Kyle mentioned, he was a fourth generation ethnic Japanese. In the kingdom, you had people who were ethnic Japanese that were Hawaiian subjects. They were natural born. A couple actually applied for naturalization. So Hawaii was very multi-ethnic, but the majority of their population was Aboriginal Hawaiian, which I am, and so is Manu. Okay. Now, what happened in 1893, which led to today, where we have 118 military bases across the Hawaiian Islands, 118 of them, not just in Pearl Harbor. Okay. And it also houses the headquarters for the Indo-Pacific Command, which is a combat command structure, right, in this part of the world for the United States. Well, in 1893, January 16th, U.S. troops invaded Honolulu, U.S. Marines and naval personnel with artillery. Okay. And eventually what occurred was the overthrow of our government. And that overthrow was investigated by President Cleveland. And he gave his remarks to the Congress in March of 1893 that the United States had committed acts of war against the Hawaiian kingdom, because those are the terms that you use when you're dealing with internationally recognized states, right? So when Germany invaded Luxembourg during World War II, that invasion of a neutral territory was an act of war. And what that does is it triggers a state of war. More importantly, it doesn't not only trigger a state of war, but also the laws of war. Now, I'm familiar with the laws of war. I served 10 years in the military. I was on both active and reserve. I'm a field artillery officer. So this is pretty much laid out in what we would call in the U.S. Army Field Manual 27-10 on the law of occupation. Now, what's important to know here with regard to Hawaii, that in 1893, what was overthrown was not the country, but the government. That means the country still exists, and that the laws of occupation require that the occupier, in this case the United States, is supposed to administer Hawaiian kingdom law. That wasn't the case, because they needed Pearl Harbor. So they basically created a false narrative once they took over Hawaii, that Hawaii wanted to be a part of the United States, and that everybody welcomed statehood. But in fact, that's the farthest from the truth. What actually happened in 1906 was a formal policy of denationalization throughout the school system, where school children, which is my grandparents' generation, were all led to believe that Hawaii is a part of the United States and that they have to speak English. By the time it got to my dad, when he was born in 1939, it's already been institutionalized. He didn't know anything about the Hawaiian kingdom. All he knew was about the United States, and he joined the Navy. For me, by the time it got to me, when I was at the commitment of schools, I had no clue about the Hawaiian kingdom. In fact, after I finished high school, I went to a military college, New Mexico Military Institute in Roswell, New Mexico, to get my commission as a second lieutenant in the Army. So when you look at these issues, okay, that is why we say under international law, Hawaii has been under a prolonged and military occupation. Now, this has been verified by the World Court, the Permanent Court of Arbitration in the Netherlands. There was a case up there, Larsen versus Hawaiian Kingdom, that lasted from 1999 to 2001. And the court verified that the Hawaiian Kingdom still exists, meaning we're not the state of Hawaii. And interesting to know, when you look at Japan, so when Japan's government was overthrown, World War II, right, and they signed a treaty of surrender on the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay, that overthrow of Japanese government did not equate to the overthrow of Japan. In fact, Japan was occupied by the U.S. military from 1945 to 1952, sorry. And they were administering Japanese law. The same was supposed to apply to us. In fact, Hawaii was the first country to have recognized Japan's independence in 1893. The first one. So when we look at it through the lens of international law, everything starts to make sense and there's more clarity. When you look at it through American law, it gets confusing. It gets to where things are swept under the rug and it creates frustrations.
Mm-hmm. So you call yourself a Hawaiian subject, and Manu calls herself a Hawaiian citizen. Why is terminology important today, and do you think terminology is starting to become more and more important as maybe it would be useful for any kind of legal argument?
Sure. Well, there's a difference between kidnapping and adoption. That's important as far as terminology. Mm. But with regard to Hawaii, through the American lens and this false narrative, it has created this idea that Hawaii was colonized by the United States. It was never colonized because you cannot colonize another country, right? It's a sovereign independent state. What you can do is occupy another country, another sovereign and independent state regulated by international law. So when we use the word occupation, more particularly belligerent occupation, then it triggers the laws of war. It triggers certain issues of remedies, but it also brings into the conversation the term war crimes. And what has happened and what has been discussed here on this show would be categorized as war crimes. So the fuel leaking into the aquifer, that would be considered destruction of property. Destruction of property by an occupying power, that's a war crime, okay? Denationalization, when we're all led to believe a false narrative that we're American, the term denationalization is a war crime. And these are not semantics. These carry consequences. So we have a federal lawsuit that is currently going on in the United States District Court in Honolulu, Hawaiian Kingdom versus Biden, and it's addressing all these issues. And what's really intriguing, which I think is quite refreshing, is that the federal court is actually following their own rules, because the evidence clearly shows the Hawaiian Kingdom still exists and it's under a belligerent occupation, and that compliance to the law of occupation has not been done by the United States. The federal magistrate, Judge Ron Trader, he actually issued an order granting what is called an amicus brief that he will use. It's called a friend of the court that he will use to help guide him in making a decision on transforming the court into an Article II occupation court, meaning a federal court that exists in occupied territory, very similar to the federal court that was in existence in Germany when it was occupied by the United States from 1945 to 1955. That's called an Article II occupation court. And an international organization of lawyers, International Association of Democratic Lawyers, the National Lawyers Guild, and the Water Protectors Legal Collective, they were the authors of this brief. And there's going to be a filing very soon, in the next couple of days, where the ideas of international law and what is called civil law will be brought before the court. And this is really getting the court to not only come to the right decision, but to inform the court on these issues from a very legal reasoning approach, and very objective, very objective. So yes, terminology is very important, especially when you're seeking to fix a problem. Terminology is not important when there is no remedy to fix the problem. But because we're in a situation of over 100 years of belligerent occupation, terminology is key, very, very much so.
Got it. Got it. All right. Well, thank you so much. That is the end of the hour. I wish we could talk a whole lot more about this. We mentioned, you know, the occupation of Hawaii. That could be a whole show in itself. Hopefully we get to bring that to you sometime in the future, because it is fascinating, and definitely we will keep our eye out on this court filing that Dr. Tsai mentioned. So I'd like to say thank you to Dr. Keanu Tsai for joining us, Manu Kaiyama, and Dr. Kyle Kajihiro. Join us tomorrow for a discussion about voting rights and redistricting here in the mainlands in Native America. I'm Andy Murphy from the Navajo Nation. Thank you so much for joining us.
With Christmas supplies and gifts in short supply, rest assured Prairie Edge and the Sioux Trading Post have you covered. Botanicals, craft supplies, beads, books, and music. We may not have it all, but we sure have a bunch at PrairieEdge.com who support this show. Wopila.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at RamonaFarms.com.
Keshe, health insurance, aqua kokshe, handa tonisto na tonistinen aptu. Yam to aqua bos awa shuru ta isto healthcare.gov with awa nan ta isto 1-800-318-2596 and pen and aqua nan aptu. Nuke sinna show Medicare and Medicaid services to na pen and itu lo kenawe. El aqua.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.